used in the context of field theory in contradistinction to gauge symmetries. But in fact, gauge symmetries aren't really symmetries. They're kind of internally part of the structure. So that's out. Categorical, well, you know, the language of mathematics is sets and functions. We like to express everything in terms of sets and functions. And if the structures we're talking about have internal structure automorphisms, then rather than sets and functions, it's categories and functors. So saying something is categorical is only saying that it's expressed in a good language. Now, if we listen to the people that talk about gravity, they will tell you that there aren't any symmetries. In which case, I'd be unemployed. So I'm going to keep the symmetry. And so let me begin today by talking about symmetry in a general way before talking about field theory. So I'm going to talk about groups and algebras. Can you see if I use this? So groups. Let me start with a little bit of taxonomy. So there's a dichotomy between discrete groups and topological groups. So a discrete group is the group you learn about. Topological group has a topology compatible with the group structure. That topology could be discrete, in which case we get the first case. Well, discrete groups, again, divide into a kind of trichotomy of finite groups, countable groups, and then uncountable groups. Can't seem to fit it. Finite groups behave quite differently, I think, than an accountable group. For example, the representations of a finite group are discrete, are rigid, they don't deform, whereas an infinite discrete group, such as the integers, can have continuous families of representations. Also, if you think about their action in geometry, a countable group, like a Fuchsian group, can have limit sets and a whole lot of phenomena that don't occur with finite groups. Now, among topological groups, the nicest kinds of groups are the finite dimensional Lie groups. And again, Lie groups can be thought of as dividing into compact and non-compact. And they too behave rather differently. Again, the representations of a compact Lie group are rigid, they don't deform. And there are lots of other kinds of topological groups as well. They're infinite dimensional Lie groups, for example. There are also kinds of p-adic groups, lots of different kinds of groups. And they're also what I might call homotopical notions of groups, called H groups. And there again, they divide into finite and less finite. Here the phrase is pi finite, the pi, if you like, for homotopy. So what I'm going to talk about in these lectures is very much kind of compact groups and their homotopical analog, and how that looks, finite groups and their homotopical analog, and how that looks in field theory. Now, of course, in field theory, there are lots of symmetries that don't fall into that. I'll mention perhaps at some point something about that. But it would be nice to extend what I'm going to say to compact Lie groups, certainly. But for now, it's just the finite analog. All right, so let me, to warm you up to this homotopical point of view, say a little bit. So let's suppose that G is a finite group, and maybe it acts on some topological space I'll call X. Then one of the constructions we do is what's called the Borel construction, where we take a classifying space for the group. So this space EG is a contractible space on which the group acts freely, and those conditions determine EG up to homotopy with some assumptions. And BG is the quotient by that G action. And what we can do is a kind of mixing construction where we cross over the group with X and we get a space we might call X sub G sitting over BG. So this is a map of topological spaces sitting over BG. And you might ask, well, where's the original space X? Well, if we have a base point in BG, and we choose a base point in the fiber here over that, then we can canonically identify the fiber sitting over the base point as our original X. So I want in this situation to say that the abstract symmetry data is the pair BG together with its base point. That's what we use to tell what kind of symmetry we're talking about. And the sort of concrete realization is also a pair. If I call that map pi, then it's a pair pi theta, if you like, where pi is a space sitting over BG. So this is some space, in this case I called it XG, sitting over BG. And theta is an identification with the fiber over the base point with our original X. So we have to be able to recover what it means for that symmetry to act on X. I have to be able to recover X. Now these lectures, I'm going to draw on lots of different ideas from lots of different places, and I'm not necessarily expecting everyone to follow all the details of everything. So if you haven't encountered this before, that's fine. Know that there will be a point soon where we'll get on to other things. So let me, to warm you up a little bit to this idea of homotopy, let me talk about what we might call a kind of homotopy fiber product. So here, when I recover X, we're taking the space sitting over BG, and we're taking the base point in BG, and we're combining those two maps. So the way you can think about it, here's BG, and here we have our space XG sitting over it, and here we have a point mapping in. And what we look for is pairs of points. There's only one point here, and we look for that point mapping in somewhere, and where it maps, we look for points here that map to the same place. So we look for pairs of points that map to the same place, and that cuts out something in this space. That's the ordinary fiber product. So imagine that we had a space on the bottom like this, and we just had two points mapping in. So this is a choice of fixed two points in the space. And if we make this kind of fiber product, well, that's going to be the empty set unless those two points coincide, in which case we get one point. In homotopy theory, you want to relax that and say that rather than two points that have to map to the same point, we have two points and we have a path between their image, a homotopy, if you like, from one map to the other. And that's what the homotopy fiber product is. So if I take two points like this that are distinct, the ordinary fiber product is empty, whereas the homotopy fiber product is the path space from one point to the other. And if the points happen to coincide, we get the loop space based at that point. So these notions of homotopy are going to enter in part as a way of constructing a very nice class of topological field theories. All right, so now I want to move on from groups to algebras. And algebras are really part and parcel of quantum theory from the beginning, quantum theory being linear. And if you think back to the inception of quantum mechanics, one of the key players then was von Neumann. And he developed, in fact, in parallel with, in the late 1920s, in parallel with the theory of quantum mechanics, the theory of operators on Hilbert space and operator algebras on Hilbert space. So the kind of algebras that I'm discussing are, as I said, not topological, like von Neumann algebras or C-star algebras, but in fact very finite. And so let's let A be an algebra, no topology. And I want you to think of, for example, a matrix algebra of n by n matrices, or perhaps, if you like, the cohomology of CPN over the complex numbers. So this is some complex algebra. And well, V is a vector space. And now what does it mean to say that A acts on V? Well, we would say that we have a left module structure. So L, we might write like this, is a left A module. And so a left module is what algebra acts on. But I want to say that what it's acting on is the vector space V. I need to recover the underlying vector space V. And to do that, we're going to take a right module. And the one we want to take is called the right regular module. And that just means that it's the vector space A with A acting on itself by right multiplication. And now, how do I recover the vector space V? Well, I take my left module and I tensor it with this right module. And then this is isomorphic to my original vector space V. So again, this R is just A as a right A module. And so if I want to abstract this in the same way that I did here, then I would say, in this case, the abstract symmetry data is the pair of the algebra and this right module. And then a concrete realization is a left module together with the choice of this isomorphism, where theta, as I said, is an isomorphism from L, whoops, R tensor over A L with V. So a couple of comments about right and left. It looks like the right module is on the left, but right and left refer to the algebra. The algebra is acting on the right. So that can be a little bit confusing. Second is about conventions with right and left. I always use right actions as structural actions and left actions as geometric actions. So here, this R is part of the structure of what we mean by saying we have this kind of abstract symmetry data in that context. And the left is something geometric. That's the concrete realization. Now, when we have an algebra, there are lots of operators in the algebra. So the algebra has elements, it has multiplication, addition, it has invertible elements, those are called the units of the algebra, certainly has non-invertible elements like zero. And anytime we have a module, then all those elements of the algebra, together with the relations they satisfy, are all reflected in every module. So if you study Lie algebras, for example, you might study the universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra. You might work out certain elements, for example, central elements called Casimirs. And then every time you have a module over the Lie algebra, those act and can tell you something about that action, but through those universal relations. Now, the two pictures are related by taking, if G is a finite group, we take the algebra to be the group algebra. And then here we're talking about actions of the group that are linear representations of the group. And again, you have elements in the group algebra. Well, so what is a typical element? Typical element is the sum of, say, lambda G, G, where G is a group element and lambda G is in the complex numbers. So you can think of that as you have the group, somewhere there's the identity, you have other elements, G. And for each group element, you have a number, like 4 minus 7.21 E pi, so on. And that's what it is. And when we want to multiply in the group algebra, we push forward under the multiplication map. So there's a multiplication map from G cross G to G. If I have a function on G and another function on G, or two elements of this group algebra, then I get something on G cross G. To know what the value is here, I look at a point here, I look at all pre-images, and I just add up, push forward. And that's the convolution product on the group algebra. Well, when you have a representation, you get a left module. And then it's, of course, we have inside of here the group. Those sit as units, invertible elements. And so that gives you the action of those group elements in the representation. But for example, central elements in the group algebra are gotten by summing group elements over a conjugacy class. And those central elements also act in a representation, but we're summing these elements. They're definitely not invertible. All right. So let me just mention that there are higher versions of this. So we could take something I'll call this kind of algebra, where we take, again, a group algebra, but with coefficients, not numbers, but coefficients, vector spaces. So if you like, we take vector bundles over the group. So in this picture, I guess you can see. So over each group element, rather than having a number, we now get a vector space. And we can again multiply two and add up, convolve, where addition is now direct sum and multiplication is now tensor product. So that's what's called a fusion algebra or a tensor category, fusion category. And notice that there's a kind of integrality. Here we're allowed any complex numbers. Here we have complex vector spaces, still the complex base, but the dimensions are integers. All right. So with that in mind, this idea of groups and algebras, and this very important distinction between an abstract group or an abstract algebra and its concrete realization, we'll turn to field theory. Let me just dwell for a second on this idea of separating out the idea of symmetries that we see in the world, honeycombs and this and that, and then this idea of an abstract group. Certainly mathematicians in the history of math and physics, symmetries were studied for a long time before the definition of an abstract group was articulated, much less the definition of an algebra. So that definition probably came sometime in the mid-1800s. If you look on Wikipedia, it says Arthur Cayley. I always thought it was Gauss who studied the theory of binary quadratic forms. But that was certainly after, for example, Galois and understanding symmetries of roots of polynomial equations, much less symmetries in geometry. And the idea that they're all the same, not the same, but the idea that there's this abstract notion of a group was a very historically important one and also a very powerful idea. Okay, so now I want to turn to field theory. And Kentaro did a great job of introducing you to ideas of field theory. And I'll talk more tomorrow in the second lecture about the framework for field theory that we use, which is what he was talking about. But let me just make a few comments so that then I can tell you the analog of what I just erased in the context of field theory. So one thing to say, is to identify what are the discrete parameters Now, what do I mean by discrete parameters? Well, often when we study something, for example, if we were constructing, say, a moduli space in geometry, we fix some discrete parameters. So if you're studying curves, the discrete parameter would be the genus, say, of the curve. If you're studying complex surfaces, there are two such parameters you might fix. If you're studying, say, representations of Lie groups, then you might fix which Lie group you're talking about. That would be the discrete parameter. So you might say it has a dimension. You might say, well, I'm going to study representations of Lie groups of dimension 8. But unless you tell me whether it's an 8-dimensional torus or it's SU3 or SU2 times SU2 times U1 times U1 or something like that, we get a very different answer. So by discrete here, I don't mean that everything that are these parameters are discrete, but I mean it's the choice that tells you what type of field theory you're studying. And here there are two of them, just as Kentaro said. And so one of them is the, let's call it N, is the dimension. And this is the dimension of space-time. If we were doing this in a Lorentzian signature relativistic way. But these axioms are for Wick-rotated field theories. But nonetheless, the N we still call the space-time dimension. And the other one I'll call F, he called S. These are what I would call the background fields. And I'll say more about that tomorrow and give you a definition. But for now, just think of this as a collection of, for example, we might have an orientation. We might have a Riemannian metric. We might have a map to maybe the real numbers mod 2 pi z. Who knows? So these are the background fields. Whatever you compute in the field theory is a function of these. So in the Bordism category he talked about, that's what Bordisms are equipped with. So maybe just a word about this. These are specific to dimension n. So what these are something that are local on all n manifolds, and there's something that can be pulled back under local diffeomorphisms of n-dimensional manifolds. So if you have an arbitrary map of manifolds, you can't pull back a Riemannian metric and get a Riemannian metric. We need to be in the same dimension, but even so, we can't take and pull back a Riemannian metric by an arbitrary map. We need something like an open embedding or a local diffeomorphism. Some of these fields are topological and some vary continuously. When we talk about topological field theories, we only have topological background fields. Now, another notion in field theory is that of a domain ball. Question? Yes?
Why you use this, the word discrete for like the background fields? Is there a discrete notion or?
Well, again, yeah, so I said that's confusing, I agree. So a Riemannian metric is not discrete in any sense of the word. But choosing to use Riemannian metrics as opposed to, for example, conformal structures, as opposed to neither, that's a discrete choice.
Yeah, okay.
That's what I mean by discrete in that context. But I agree it's a confusing word. So think of that as specifying the type of field theory. It's the dimension in these background fields. So what is a domain wall? Well, and here I'm afraid you won't see very well these colors, but nonetheless. Imagine that we have some theory sigma 1. It could be topological, it might not be. And then we have another theory sigma 2, and a domain wall is something that sits here. Maybe delta, and it really has a direction. It goes from sigma 1 to sigma 2, so you can think of that as a co-orientation on here. So that's the schematic. And what it means is that in terms of the Bordism category that Kentaro talked about, we take our Bordisms of whatever dimension and we color them by the theory sigma 1, the theory sigma 2, and then the theory delta is colored on codimension 1 submanifolds that separate those regions. And what it to have a domain wall is to say that the functor is extended to such colorings of manifolds. So we can think of this as a sigma 1. I guess that's a sigma 2, sigma 1 bimodule. Yeah, so in the analogy, I want to think of this field theory as being something like an algebra. But again, that's a little bit dangerous because I'm not saying the field theory is an algebra object in any sense of the word. But nonetheless, this domain wall I can think of as a kind of bimodule between two algebras. So here we had one-sided modules, and here we have a bimodule. But we could, so topological, I mean, field theories in general have a composition law. Sometimes physicists call this stacking. It's a tensoring where we have two quantum systems and we consider them together without interaction. So for example, all the state spaces become tensor products of the state spaces of one system and the other, and so on. And there's also a unit theory. The unit theory has, for example, one quantum state, a one-dimensional state space on every manifold. So we can specialize this to boundaries, what I call boundary theories. So boundary conditions, as opposed to data, conditions are something you encounter in classical physics. For example, if you study the Laplace equation on a manifold with boundary, you might give a condition on the functions restricted to the boundary. But in field theory, you're giving data on the boundary. And so I call that a boundary theory. And so that's setting, for example, sigma 1, well, sigma 2 equal to this unit theory. And so in that case, we get a picture where we have here's sigma, and then here's this theory, I guess I call it delta. And so this is then, you see sigma's on the right of delta, so I'm afraid this is called a right boundary theory, or perhaps a right sigma module. And similarly, we can have it on the left. Okay, so there are two different notions of boundary theories that can occur on the left or the right, and there are special cases of domain walls where we think of having the unit theory here, but this unit theory is transparent, it can be erased. Okay, well, with that understood, I can give you now the central definitions of the lecture. Series. The first definition is of the abstract symmetry, and the second will be of concrete symmetry. So definition one will say fix an integer n. Well, we could consider zero-dimensional field theories, I suppose. But anyway, fix that. Then we could say that n-dimensional symmetry data, or field theoretic symmetry data, is a pair sigma rho where sigma is an n plus 1 dimensional topological field theory. And rho is a right boundary theory. So saying that the theory sigma is topological is what's enforcing the analogy with finite groups or finite algebras. Topological field theories have a lot of finiteness that follows from just the structure. Notice that we're defining what's going to act on n-dimensional field theories, but this theory sigma, this topological field theory, is dimension n plus 1. And this rho is a right boundary theory. It's playing the role of what was the right module in the algebra case, or what was the base point in the case of BG. Now there's a notion of having rho to be a regular boundary theory. That also goes under the name Dirichlet. And that makes sense, at least more obviously. We could discuss a more general idea, but it makes sense if this field theory is taking values in some kind of algebras. And then we have the notion of the right regular module for that algebra. But let me right now not say more about that. You'll notice that I went through the trouble of telling you what the discrete parameters are, and I told you here what the dimension is, but I didn't tell you what f is. And these background fields will often stay in the background in these lectures, and I think they're often in the background generally when people talk about field theory. But they are there, and I do recommend you think about them.
All right. Sorry, Dan, I have a question from the chat.
Yeah.
Is rho a topological boundary condition?
Yes. Yes, thank you. Yes, absolutely. Thank you. So, yes.
Is the sigma topological field theory a classical field theory or a quantum field theory?
Well, in these axioms, there is no distinction between classical and quantum formally, but let me just say the answer to your question is quantum. Thank you, that's an important point. So I will do an example shortly and to illustrate these ideas. And in that example, sigma is going to be exactly the finite gauge theory in two dimensions that Kentaro talked about in his lecture for a finite group G, but it's the quantum version of that theory. All right, so let me then say what definition two. So fix sigma rho. Let me also say about definition one that it's a mouthful to say those words. If you have better words, you know, field theoretic symmetry, whatever I called it. If you have better words, I would welcome them. But we'll just talk about a pair of sigma rho. So fix sigma rho. Then let's call it a sigma rho module structure on an n-dimensional field theory F is a pair F tilde theta, where F tilde is a left boundary theory for a sigma, and theta is an isomorphism from the tensor product of those left and right over sigma with our original theory F. So very much in parallel to what I told you for algebras. So the picture is that we have sigma, this n plus one dimensional theory, and on the left, in green, if you can tell that, in green is this theory, rho. And this part of the theory is all topological. But now we have another theory, F, that you surely can't see, which is a quantum field theory. And to say that this structure, X on F, is to give a left boundary here, F tilde, which is not necessarily topological, and an isomorphism theta of this with F. So what does this mean? Well, what does this tensor product mean? Well, that tensor product is, if you like, a dimensional reduction of sigma, where on the left, we have this topological theory, rho. In the bulk, we have sigma, and on the right, we have this not necessarily topological theory, F tilde. So sigma is n plus one dimensional, and this reduction, or this tensor product, or if you like, this sandwich, where we're thinking of this theory sigma is sandwiched between the right and the left boundary theories, the right and the left modules. Yes?
What's wrong with saying that F is the boundary as opposed to F tilde? I'm trying to understand why you're emphasizing the distinction between them.
Well, hang on for 3 minutes, and when I show you the example, I think you'll see that. But it's the same distinction that I drew in the case of an algebra. When we have a left module, the structure that's there is a vector space L together with a map from A tensor L to L. When I think of the vector space, that map from A tensor L to L is not part of the structure. So it's a different object. Okay. So this should seem rather abstract, and I think I need to give you an example, which I'll do in a second. Let me just say that one of the virtues we're about to see of this picture is that this part is topological, whereas this is the part that's allowed to be not topological. And when we make computations in the theory sigma rho, which means this n plus one theory with its right boundary that's topological, those computations are like computations in an abstract algebra, like the universal algebra, enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra. Those apply universally to any theory on which this acts as a symmetry. And what we compute with, what are the analogs of elements of an algebra, are called defects in the theory. So those play the role, and the defects act as defects in any module, in any theory on which this symmetry acts. So in fact, the domain wall and the boundary theories are examples of defects, and we're about to see more examples. One other thing to say is, how is this symmetry used? And this, I think, will come out in the other lecture series more than in mine, is that if you have a quantum field theory that depends on scale and so on, and you start varying parameters, like take a renormalization group flow, then it's expected that this symmetry will persist. So it's not only a flow of theories, but it's a flow of this structure. And then whatever you get has to, again, live on the boundary of this theory. And so that's a powerful way in which symmetry is used to constrain dynamics.
Dan, I have a couple of questions from the chat.
Yep.
So are different thetas supposed to capture the different actions of the symmetry on F?
Yes.
And then the other, do you assume sigma is an oriented topological field theory?
No. So again, as I said, I'm keeping in the notation and in these statements, the background fields are implicit, but they have to be there everywhere. So this symmetry could be a symmetry that's an oriented theory, a spin theory. It could be an unoriented theory, whatever kinds of background fields you want, that's what the notion applies to. But you specify that in advance. Yes.
Thank you. I believe you mentioned that this TQFT is not algebra, but this is probably a very basic question, but what is the module? What is the definition?
Well, I'm using the language this way in analogy with the language of algebras, but I'm not suggesting that the theory sigma is an algebra.
Are the background fields on the regular boundary theory always the same as the one-dimensional theory?
No, thank you for the question. So, yes, so there's a lot I'm sweeping under the rug about these background fields. But, for example, you could have a unoriented theory, topological theory here, and this boundary theory could, for example, depend on a spin structure. So what's needed is that, in the sense I'll describe tomorrow, the background fields on the boundary have to map to the background fields in the bulk. All right, so if we could switch to the iPad, then... that's the board. Fantastic. So so here are some pictures. And so I want to discuss in this lecture, I'll just have time for one example. And this example is quantum mechanics. So I want to think of the quantum mechanical theory as being here. The quantum mechanical theory is a theory that is defined by a Hilbert space and a Hamiltonian acting on that Hilbert space. It's a one-dimensional theory. So in the terms that I've said, the discrete parameters, the n is equal to 1. And the background fields, the script f, is a pair consisting of an orientation and a Riemannian metric. Now, in the terms Kentaro said, it's a map from one-dimensional Bordism category of 0 and 1 manifolds into, well, into vector spaces. But these are topological vector spaces. They're allowed to be infinite dimensional, but once you have infinite dimensional vector spaces, it's much better if they're topological vector spaces. They're not Hilbert spaces, they're more general topological vector spaces. So for example, at the first order statement you might say is that what you attach to a point in this theory F is the Hilbert space H. But in fact, the point is not what's in the Bordism category. It's really the point sitting inside a little piece of a one manifold where the one manifold has your fields. It's oriented and has a metric. So technically, you only want the germ of that one manifold. Two of them are equivalent if they agree on some open neighborhood of that point. So you really have a little germ of a Riemannian one manifold. And if you have that, what's attached to the point is not just the Hilbert space, but a little germ of the evolution. The evolution is Wick rotated, so what you essentially learn is the Hamiltonian. That's the generator of that evolution. If you have a Bordism, which is the manifold given by a closed interval, then that has a metric, so up to isometry, the only invariant is the length, called tau. And then what that interval assigns, if you think of it as a Bordism from incoming point to outgoing point, then it's a linear map, and that linear map is the evolution, e to the minus tau, tau being the length, Hamiltonian divided by h bar. So Kentaro mentioned, by the way, a preprint of Kontsevich and Siegel, where they talk about the axioms, this kind of Bordism, this map from Bordism to topological vector spaces. They talk about that axiom system for non-topological theories. And I also highly recommend a series of lectures Graham Siegel gave in Bonn more than 10 years ago, where he lays out a lot of the issues that arise when you go from topological to non-topological theories. Well, now let's imagine that there's a group G, a finite group G, which acts on the Hilbert space linearly, and it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So that's what we would say is a symmetry of this quantum mechanical system. So how does that look in this picture? Well, we're going to take the two-dimensional theory, That's this sigma, which is exactly the finite gauge theory that Kentaro talked about. So one often thinks when you have a symmetry G that you couple the theory to a background G bundle. And indeed, this theory is gotten by summing over G bundles, summing over G bundles in two dimensions, if you like. And so that incorporates this idea, but to answer the question, is this classical or quantum? It's quantum, meaning we've summed over the G bundles. So this is an example of a theory which is constructed by a finite sum, finite version of the path integral. And the general type of those theories are called finite homotopy theories, and I'll talk about those more tomorrow. And those are a particularly nice class of theories. Not all topological theories by any means are like that, not at all. But they are a nice class that, first of all, it's a nice playground for general quantum theories. If you want to ask about defects, you can ask about defects in these theories. It's very computable using techniques of topology. And secondly, these do come up in many examples, as you'll see, as symmetries of, for example, four-dimensional gauge theories. So they come up as symmetries of realistic systems, here as a symmetry of a quantum mechanical system. So the algebra that is attached to a point in this theory is the group algebra, just as I discussed before. And this boundary theory is the right regular module in those terms, or in terms of the gauge theory, it's summing over bundles, which are trivialized on this boundary. Now, these pictures that I'm drawing are schematic, and particularly when I get to higher dimensions, you might be evaluating your theory on some manifold, and this picture is a kind of, you know, just a tubular neighborhood of some little piece in that manifold. But anyway, it's a schematic picture that tells you. All right. So I want to talk about defects in this theory. And again, I'll give a general discussion about defects tomorrow. But let's first think about this quantum mechanical theory, non-topological theory. And we want to think about a point defect. I've called delta here. And as Kentaro said, what you do is you look at the link of this submanifold. That link is these two points, or better said, the zero sphere. And so one of those points is positively oriented, one is negatively oriented. And we want to evaluate this theory F on that link. Well, if we do that, then at least naively, we get the Hilbert space on the plus point and the dual of that space on the minus point. And so that's the space of endomorphisms, or operators. And of course, that's what you expect in quantum mechanics as a point defect. You expect at a point of time to insert an operator or an observable. Now, in fact, also Kentaro said this, you have to take a limit as this link shrinks. And it's a kind of inverse limit. And then the kind of operators you get are much more singular. They're not bounded or Hilbert-Schmidt operators. And that's, in fact, exactly what you want for observables in quantum mechanics. So if we're in this theory F, and we have, for example, this picture, where time runs up, so it's an interval of length tau 3 minus tau naught, and we insert at these times these observables, then this, under the theory F, evaluates to this linear map from the Hilbert space to the Hilbert space. So that's the typical kind of correlation function with these defects inserted. All right. Well, now we want to look at this picture where we have the G symmetry. And so we look at it at what you might call the sandwich picture. Well, in this picture, we can look at defects in this theory, this two-dimensional theory with these boundaries, and then transport them by the isomorphism theta to defects in the original quantum mechanical theory. So I'm going to do that now for a bunch of different defects that will transport to point defects over in the physical theory. So here I'm taking a defect which is on this F tilde colored boundary. That's the one that's not topological. And I don't think I answered Clay's question. So Clay, here this F is the Hilbert space, the system, and this F tilde is that Hilbert space viewed with its G action. That's the difference. Okay, so if we want to know what a observable is here, well, we should take the link. Now the link is this closed interval. It's kind of semicircle. It's the link in this two-dimensional theory, but it's the link of a point in the boundary. So that link is unfurled here. And we have to evaluate this again in the theory sigma with these boundary theories, with the boundary theory F on the two endpoints. And what we get, I'm just telling you these answers, is we get operators on H that commute with the group algebra, or commute with the G action. So these are the G invariant operators. So when I transport under theta, I get an operator at that point, which is G invariant. Again, implicitly, we have to take a limit as that link shrinks, and so we're getting these singular operators. Well, what if I take a point on the other side? Well, this, remember, this part is all topological. Yes, that's what it means to say the G acts on the system.
Oh, I know, but I wanted to understand it from this definition. You said that here you get the G invariant operators. How correct. Do you see that the Hamiltonian is in that set?
Oh. I'll show you that on this slide. Let me continue and then I'll answer that. Yeah, thanks for the question. Okay, so let's suppose that we have a point defect on this row boundary. Well, that, as I said, is topological. Its link now is this, which again is sitting in the topological part of the theory. So when we evaluate that, we're purely in this two-dimensional topological gauge theory with this topological boundary. You can think of it that we're summing over G bundles on this interval, and what this boundary is in these semi-classical terms is giving a trivialization of that G bundle. So the mapping space, the collection of G bundles with those trivializations is just a copy of the group, because we have the parallel transport from one end to the other. And so the functions on that, which is the quantization, is exactly the group algebra. So what labels this defect is a point of the group algebra. So again, that element of the group algebra might be a group element. That's a kind of classical label. And that's what you'll hear, that when you, to say it's a G symmetry, we have these codimension one defects that are topological labeled by the group elements. And that's true here. But we could also have other elements of this algebra that aren't invertible, also labeling that defect. Now, since this defect is topological, if I'm evaluating the theory on some bordism like this, for example, it might be literally what's pictured here, a closed interval in this direction, we have the Riemannian metric and orientation here, but we don't have any background fields here. We don't have a width of this, for example. Okay, that was Will's question before. Are the background fields on the boundaries the same as the interior? Well, for this gauge theory, we don't need any background fields. It's an unoriented theory. But for this quantum mechanics, we need an orientation and a Riemannian metric. So there's a diffeomorphism that just moves this point anywhere you like, and it won't change any answers. So what is this? This is the time evolution. And then at this particular time, we insert this operator corresponding to an element of the algebra. Well, now you can see that it's invariant. It doesn't matter if I move this up and down. You see, that's moving here away from anything happening in the non-topological part. So that's the invariance of the Hamiltonian. Also, if you imagine having one of these defects now over here, together with the one on the row boundary. Well, this defect doesn't move so freely. This isn't topological. But I could move this defect. And that means that in time, when I come over here, this topological one might occur before the other one or after the other one. But the answer can't change because, again, it's topological over here. And that's true, and that's because these defects coming from here commute with the group action. All right. Well, we could also have a point defect sitting in the interior. Well, what's its link? Its link is now the circle. We can evaluate this gauge theory on the circle. We have to sum over G bundles on the circle. And what we get is a vector space which could be identified with the central functions on the group, or if you like, the center of this group algebra. So that's, again, a general theme that the defects that are supported in the bulk, the topological ones, away from this row boundary, those tend to be central in a certain sense. And here you can imagine, again, if we had an element on this other boundary that's labeled by a group element, well, we can move this one on the boundary, we can move this one anywhere we like. And of course, when we project here, those two will commute, and that's precisely indicating that this is in the center of the group. Well, we still haven't gotten the general defect over here. We got the operators that commute, we got the operators of the symmetry in this algebra, but the general one, we have to take a one-dimensional defect in this theory, which is indicated in yellow, which ends on the two ends. And now you have to go through a procedure to label this defect. Well, you have to look at the link. So this is a stratified manifold. It's a manifold with boundary. But you look at the higher dimensional strata first, and then you work your way down. So when you look at the highest dimensional stratum in the interior, you have this link. And you can work out in the topological gauge theory that that corresponds to having a bimodule. And then, I'll say more about that tomorrow. Then we could look at these, this endpoint, its link, and this endpoint, its link. And notice this link now has this bimodule appearing. That's why we have to do it in that order. And what you get is a vector in the underlying vector space of the bimodule. What you get here is a bimodule map from B to the operators. And so when we project over, what we get is just this map applied to this vector. And in that way, we can realize a general operator. All right. You can imagine lots more kinds of defects. For example, you could imagine a defect like this bottom one that just ends in the middle. You could imagine a defect like this. We could imagine something coming off of here. We could have lots of stratified manifolds and defects. And so I did make some problems, and one of the problems is to figure out, for example, what label goes at this endpoint, and what do these defects correspond to in the quantum mechanical theory. Now, this is a nice example to spend some time with because it's a simple enough example. The quantum mechanics, there's no question what is a quantum mechanical system. As I said, von Neumann worked that out long ago to a mathematical kind of level. And still, a lot of features that we'll see in the lectures are reflected here. So one of them, if I can have 5 minutes, one of them is what happens when I commute defects. So here, let's imagine these defects, which I'm calling row defects because they live on this row boundary. And imagine we have an invertible one, this G, labeled by a group element, and then a general one here, which is labeled by an element of the algebra. Well, we can imagine moving this G because it's a topologically invariant theory. But when I move it, I might run into this other defect, and then I can't move. That's not a diffeomorphism. But what I need to do is to combine them into one, and that's a multiplication or a fusion on defects. And the way you can think about it is that we look at the links. That's what, after all, labels the defects. And as we move, these links kind of come closer together, and then at some point they fuse into one link. And so we get a two-dimensional boardism, which looks like that. And, well, you can imagine drawing that. That's what's called the pair of chaps, not the pair of pants. And it leads, once you evaluate in this theory sigma with the boundary theory rho, it leads to just multiplication in the algebra in one order or another, depending on choices. And so we multiply. Well, you can imagine doing it from the other side. And what you see is that if you make the labels this way, then when I bring them together, I get the same thing as that. So you can see that this G needed to be invertible, passed through at the expense of acting on this defect. It acted by the way the group acts on operators by conjugation. Well, finally, we can imagine doing this where now we don't have this topological defect stuck on that boundary, but we have a general defect. So remember, that's a general operator in the quantum theory. And so when I bring it down, the main point I want to emphasize is that this bringing it down and doing this product is all happening in the topological part of the theory. I'm never moving anything in this non-topological part. So it's a calculation in topological field theory a theory for which we have a lot of tools and a lot of theorems and a lot of techniques for doing it. And so the computation is exactly the same as it was before. It's that computation in field theory. But now, when I take and bring that defect over by the isomorphism theta into the quantum mechanical theory, I find that the operator becomes that when I combine. And when I move past, well, I find it's this, which is just the operator conjugated. So in other words, the way that I move past a point defect, you see it's moving this defect down and past the T. When that happens, it acts on the operator. But that, as I say, is a computation in this topological field theory, once you have this picture. So I think I'm out of time. I wrote quite a bit of notes for this, and one thing I terribly neglected to say at the beginning, so I hope I can amend that now, is that the ideas I'm telling you grew out of discussions last summer with Constantine Telemann and Greg Moore, and since many other people, of course. And there's a paper in progress, and I've adapted parts of the paper and added quite a bit and made lecture notes to go with the lecture. So they should be appearing on this website. And as instructed, I also made some problems. So so again, I realize that I'm throwing a lot out there. There's a lot more in the notes than I have time to say in the lecture. And the problems also draw on lots of different things, but that's by design. And hopefully that'll get people talking to each other and working together on the problems, particularly mathematicians from different fields and mathematicians and physicists together and so on. So thank you.
I prefer to think of quantum mechanics as the algebra of operators itself. So, and an isomorphism is an isomorphism of algebras, and a symmetry is a map from G to the automorphisms of that. What changes in this formalism, like these definitions, for example?
Well, let me answer that in a kind of general way, if I can, and we'll see if that answers it. So if I think about axiomatizations of quantum theory, the first axiomatizations of quantum mechanics, there are two of them. One is due to Dirac and von Neumann, which is the kind of one that I'm doing here, which in a sense emphasizes states and the evolution of states in time. The other one is emphasizing algebras. That too was von Neumann, but also Siegel, Irving Siegel in that case, and others. And that operator point of view is sometimes, I think, called the Heisenberg kind of point of view, where you emphasize the operators, which I think is the direction of your question. Sometime later, in flat Minkowski space-time, when quantum field theory has different axiomatizations, one due to Whiteman, which is, again, a kind of Schrodinger picture, which is the Dirac von Neumann, and then the one due to Kostler, Hogg, and Kostler, which is more focused on the operators. And in fact, those have modern echoes in this more geometric, wick-rotated on curve space, Riemannian axiomatizations. The one that I'm talking about, initiated by Graham Siegel, is very much the Schrodinger picture. And the one that Kevin Costello and Owen Gwilliam and others are doing is more, I would say, like the Hogg-Kostler or a kind of Schrodinger picture. So all that said is to say that the framework that I'm using in these lectures is very much the Schrodinger picture. So I'm sure you can rephrase what I said in the other picture, but I just want to say that's the way that I'm approaching it.
I have a question about which part in this description requires the symmetry to be finite? Is it that theta is an isomorphism?
Good question, thank you. So what requires G to be finite, let's say in this particular example, what forces that is to say that I have a full two-dimensional field theory in the bulk. Now, we could relax that, and since we're interested in the boundary theory, we could relax that and just say we have a one-dimensional theory in the bulk. but not a one-dimensional theory that attaches numbers to one manifolds, but it attaches vector spaces. So that we might call a once categorified one-dimensional field theory. And if I relax in that way, then that relaxes the finiteness conditions imposed. And in that case, you could, for example, take a countable discrete group and put it in the middle, acting on quantum mechanics. So if you had a group like SL2Z acting on some quantum mechanical system, you could do it in this framework. You wouldn't get the full two-dimensional theory. But if you ask me to get topological groups, like a Lie group of symmetries, then we're going to have to do something new, much newer in the bulk to try to encode that. And I don't know how to do that. Did that answer the question? Okay. But again, the basic answer is that being a topological field theory imposes very strong finiteness conditions.
Yeah, I have a question. Is there a reason why the regular boundary condition is called Dirichlet, and also the trivial one is called Neumann?
Why is it called Dirichlet?
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to Neumann yet. Well, in the example of gauge theory, so we're going to have this semi-classical picture where we sum over bundles. And the Dirichlet is introducing another fluctuating field, if you like, on the boundary, which is a trivialization of the bundle. So that's like the equation that says this bundle is equal to trivial. That's like Dirichlet saying the function that, on which you're acting, the Laplacian, has boundary value zero or something. So I suppose that might be a motivation for Dirichlet.
Okay, thank you.
Dan, I have some questions from the chat. Are there distinctions for path integral formulation or canonical quantization picture, maybe related to an earlier question?
Well, so I'll talk more tomorrow about this axiom system for quantum theory. But this axiom system it doesn't have fluctuating fields in it. It only has the background fields. So however you arrived at the correlation functions, the partition functions, the state space, what is being axiomatized is those answers, not the process by which you arrive at those answers, starting from another point. So that means that you don't know how it was arrived at in this axiom system. So you can't tell if this is a theory with a Lagrangian, without any of that. That's not what these axioms are about.
And there is another question. Are there distinctions for the H-type or L-type quantum theory?
Well, I think it's what I just said in answer to the previous question, that we can ask whether the bulk theory, which is an n plus one dimensional theory the way I had it, we could relax that to be an n-dimensional once categorified theory. In which case, we would say instead of a boundary theory, what we have is a relative field theory would be the word I would use in that context. And so at least in the topological case, Will Stewart is working on kind of some versions of that. Theo and Claudia Scheinbauer also have a paper about that, and there's a poster out there. So there is some theory in that direction, which is, as I say, relaxing the finiteness conditions, one way to think about it.
And I have another question here. In the example, how is the group algebra and its modules related to a QFT being a functor?
Well, so the QFT is a map from Bordism to topological vector spaces. And if I just think about the quantum mechanics, it's, as I said, a zero and one-dimensional Bordism category where the manifolds are equipped with an orientation and a Riemannian metric. If I think about this sandwich picture, if you like, then it's a two-dimensional theory. I have to up the target so that I can capture two dimensions. But now what kind of domain do we have? What kind of Bordisms? Well, we're going to have Bordisms in a zero, one, two-dimensional theory, but we're allowed to color boundaries with these right or left boundary theories. So it's a theory where you have a richer Bordism category on which we can evaluate the theory. And because it's the theory of this finite gauge theory, it's encoding the symmetry acting on that left boundary.
Hi. I have a question. So here you are using the example of like finite gauge theory because you want to model a finite group like zero form symmetry. Can you use like other topological field theory to model like more generalized symmetries?
Yes. So again, I don't have. Yes. So so at the beginning, I talked about how we think of the G symmetry and we say it in a homotopical way in terms of BG. But we could replace BG by another topological space. It needs a base point, which corresponds to that regular or Dirichlet boundary theory. And to do this analog of finite, we need that space to be what's called pi finite, meaning that it has finitely many non-zero homotopy groups, each of which is a finite group on each path component of the space. And so we can make lots of choices for that, and we'll see that in these lectures. So for example, what you might call a one-form A symmetry, where A is a finite abelian group, that corresponds to what in topology I think we would say is the group BA. It's a group in a homotopical sense. And then the space becomes the classifying space of BA, which is the second classifying space of A, or an Eilenberg-MacLane space. So we could put that space there. But then we could start building other spaces that have more non-zero homotopy groups. It might have a pi 1 and a pi 2, a combination of BG and B squared A, but they can exist in an extension, the same way groups exist in extensions. We can have Cartesian products, but we can have one group acting on the other. We can have extensions and so on. And so those are called two groups, and we can do further. So yes, they'll all appear.
So let's thank Dan again, and now we have...